Good morning from Northern California. We are about to start another new episode of Emily Carr. Just brewed myself a second cup of coffee this morning. I don't know why, but I feel like I need it. I had a nice breakfast, and I was sitting here thinking I'd like another cup of coffee this morning. It's good. Okay. So, we are now about halfway through the book. No, I guess so. About 150 pages. This chapter is called Pain and Mrs. Radcliffe, The Vicarage. The doctor found my foot had a dislocated toe, a split bone. Results of an old injury. His treatment made no improvement. "We will have to amputate that toe," he said. "I do not care to do it, though, without the consent of your home people. Your general condition is bad." "To write home and wait an answer will take so long. Do it this afternoon. I want to go back to school. Please do it quick." "Not so fast. The fact is, I do not care to take the responsibility." "It's my foot. I have no parents." "Tell Cousin Marion to come and see me," said the surgeon. Mrs. Radcliffe went. "I will accept responsibility," she told her cousin. "If that toe must come off, do it." "To me," she said, prefacing her words as usual with, "Dear me." "My cousin is a good surgeon. If he says amputation is best, it is. You don't mind, I suppose. Don't feel sentimental over a toe?" "Goodness, no. I only want to get back to work." "Of course, a toe is not like your hand or head." "I've told Corey to go ahead," said Mrs. Radcliffe. The foot went wrong. I suffered cruelly. Every day, Mrs. Radcliffe tramped near London, tramped clear across London in fierce heat to sit by my bed. She kept a vase full of red roses, velvety red ones with the glorious smell, always fresh by my bedside. She sat close, rocking in a rocker. The toe of her shoe struck the bed with every rock. Each vibration was agony, but I would not cry out. I bit my lips, and my cheeks were scarlet. Excuse me. Excuse me. That came on fast. She said to the nurse, "Cleewick looks fine. Such bright color. That foot must be doing splendidly." "She is suffering," said the nurse. "Oh, well. The restless creature. Doubtless she bangs that foot about all night." I longed to yell, "Turn the cruel old thing out!" And yet, when Mrs. Radcliffe had gone, I turned my face into the pillow, crying, counting the hours until she would come again. She was my strength. Without her, I was jelly. Excuse me. Mr. Ford sent his daughter with flowers. Aunt Amelia Green came, wagging her pinched little head, saying, "I told you, you should never have left my house. My Canadian nieces were the same. Wayward." Waddy had won her diploma. She was down in Cambridgeshire at her father's vicarage. She wrote, "Come to us, Carlite, the moment they will let you leave the nursing home. You will love the vicarage garden, the old, wonderful old church. I will take such care of you." When Waddy left London, I had moved to Mrs. Dodd's big boarding house for students. The vicarage garden was a tangled wilderness, the church and vicarage tumbling down. The vicar had passed his 80th year and was daughtery. I'm not still into this. Sometimes it takes me a few bit of reading to get back into this story. Sorry. The vicar had passed his 80th year and was daughtery. He was, however, still possessed of a beautiful intoning voice, so the church retained his services. Watty, from her seat in the choir, her sister from the organ bench, agonizingly watched their father. After the vicar had filled the solemn old church with his voice, reading lessons and intoning the service, his strength was spent. Tottering up the pulpit stair, gasping out the text of his sermon, his eye roved vaguely over the congregation. A halting sentence or two, a feeble lifting of his arms to bless, the congregation was dismissed to its dinner. But for the old man's prattle, Sunday dinner in the vicarage would often have been very sad. One after the other, his three daughters, taking me aside, said, "Father ought to be retired," but in the next breath, "Isn't his intoning rich, voice rich and mellow?" They were proud of him, but the church was not being fair to the congregation. The vicarage garden was high-walled with red brick, circled by venerable elm trees, in which was a rookery. Daws and starlings chattered around the disused stable. The vicar could not afford to keep a horse. He had an old gardener, an old cook, and an old nurse to maintain, as well as himself and three daughters. The daughters helped to eke out the living expenses by teaching drawing and music and by running his house. The cook was too old to cook, the gardener too old to dig, the nurse too old to be bothered with children. Besides, the vicarage nursery had been empty for the last 15 years. I had to look at, see, for some reason it didn't look like it was recording. Watty, scouring the unpruned rose bushes for a house posy, said to me, "Our gardener's beyond work, besides which he is lazy and drunken. Why don't you sack him?" "Carlite, sack an old servant? In England, servants remain with us until they die." "What do they do?" "Cook can still peel potatoes. The gardener sweeps up the paths when he's not too drunk to hold the broom. Nurse dusts the nursery and makes our underwear all by hand." "Can't she run a sewing machine?" Our family wearing machine-made body linen? "Oh, Carlite. Dozening hands stitches when you could million better, stronger ones by machine? Life's too short. Come to Canada, Watty." "Canada? Why, Carlite, England is the only place in the whole world to live." "Your brothers have all gone abroad, haven't they?" "Men are different, more adventurous. The world needs educated Englishmen. All my seven brothers went to college. It meant pinching a bit at home. They have all done so well for themselves in the civil service. India, China. Why don't they do a bit for you girls now? Make up for your pinch. Why should everything be for the boys and men in England?" "Mother brought us up that way. The boys first, always. The boys have wives now." "I'm glad I'm Canadian. I don't like your English ways, Watty." "Being English is my greatest pride, Carlite." A narrow-walled way led from the side door of the vicarage to the church vestry, a somber interlude in which to bottle secular thoughts and uncork sacred. Through a squeaky hinged gate, you could pass from vicarage garden to church town. Through a squeaky hinged gate, you could pass from vicarage garden to churchyard, from overgrown shady green to sunny, close-clipped graves. Some of these had gay posies snuggled to the tombstones. Some stones staggered and tipped, almost as if they were dancing on the emerald turf. Everything was so somber about the vicarage and church, it made the graves seem almost hilarious. Gaiety accompanied you through the churchyard, but at the threshold of the church, the merry spirit fell back into the sunlight, sky, air of the graveyard. The church was too dead, too dreary for that bright spirit. It belonged to life, to perpetual living. "Rebellious Carlite," Waddy would say with a shake of her head and a few swaying rocks to my shoulders. "Rebellious little Carlite." There had been moments when I nearly envied Waddy's uneventful calm at art school. We worked easel to easel. Waddy's work was stable, evenly good. Sometimes my work was better than hers, sometimes worse. She neither lifted nor sank. She had enough South Kensington certificates to paper the vicarage. I had none. She knew art history from the creation to now. She knew the Elgin marbles in the National Gallery, the South Kensington Museum, all the art treasures of London. She knew the anatomical structure of the human body, bone for bone. She stepped with reverent tiptoeing among the stone couches of the great ones in the Architectural Museum. But neither our art nor our hearts had anything in common other than that we loved one another deeply. Each went her own way, unfalteringly staunch to her own ideals. When our ideals clashed, each jumped back into silence, because we wanted to keep both our friendship and our own opinion. Kicking the Regent Street Shoeman. I can only imagine what this is about. Mrs. Radcliffe's surgeon cousin advised a surgical support in my shoe. "I will take her to my own shoeman in Regent Street," said Mrs. Radcliffe, and off we went. My foot was very sore, very painful to the touch, for a long time after the operation. I said to the fitter, "Do not handle the shoe when it is on my foot. I will put it on and off myself." It was a very swell shop. The clerks were obsequious, oily tongues, oily hair, oily dignity, and long-tailed black coats like parsons. Our salesman was officious. He would persist in poking, prodding, pressing the shoe to my foot, in spite of my repeated protests. At last, angry with pain, I shouted, "You stop that!" Mrs. Radcliffe explained to him that I had recently had an operation on my foot, which had left it tender. The man still persisted in pinching. After he had forced about 7 squeals out of me, I struck with the well foot, giving the princely creature such a quick kick square in midships that he sprawled flat and backwards, hitting his head against a pile of shoeboxes, which came clattering down on him, spreading him like a starfish. Every customer, every clerk in the store paused in consternation, while the enraged shoeman picked himself up. "Clay Wick!" gasped Mrs. Radcliffe. "Well, he would persist when I told him not to," I cried. "Serves him right." I dragged on my old shoe by myself, and we left the shop. Mrs. Radcliffe marching in stony grim quiet, while I limped beside her, silent also. We waited for our bus, standing among all the Oxford Circus flower women on the island. The flowers were gay in their baskets. The women poked them under our noses. "Tuppence a penny, a bunch, lady? Only tuppence?" They do smell nice, don't they, Mrs. Radcliffe? Mrs. Radcliffe's thoughts were back in the Regent Street shoe shop. 30 years, she moaned, I have dealt there. Dear me, I shall never be able to face those clerks again. Our bus jangled up to the curb. We got in. I knew I was not a nice person. I knew I did not belong to London. I was honestly ashamed of myself, but London was, I wanted my West. I wasn't a London lady. Are you saved? I took my letter from the rack and read it while waiting for Mrs. Dodds, my landlady, to finish toting up a long row of figures. I liked going down to pay my weekly board. Mrs. Dodds's office was cozy. She was kindly. She knew London like a book and could tell every one of her 50 lady student boarders all they wanted to know about everything and every place in the world. I won't, I exclaimed, reading down the page. Mrs. Dodds looked up from her figuring. Won't what? Pay a snob visit in Upper Norwood over the weekend. I don't know the people. The Handel Festival is being held this week. It is in the Crystal Palace, which is at Upper Norwood. Probably that is why your friends are inviting you down. Don't miss a treat like that, child. They are not my friends. I've never seen them. My sister did the woman a kindness when she was ill out in Canada. The woman thinks she ought to pay back. Well, let her. Why not? She does not owe me anything. They have money. I refuse to bring over a letter of introduction to her. I won't have anybody feel that they have got to be good to me because my sister was good to them. They don't owe me a thing. Take all the fun that comes your way. Don't be stupid. That foot operation has taken it out of you. Go. Have a good time. I'd like to hear that festival, all right. On reconsidering, I wrote. I've had an operation on my foot. I still limp. If you will excuse a limp in a soft shoe, I will be pleased, etc. I loathed the snoopy little woman with boiled gooseberry eyes from the moment I saw her peering down the platform looking for something resembling my sister's. She knew all about my foot and that I was just out of a nursing home. My sister had written her. They had corresponded ever since they met in Victoria. I suppose you can walk. It is only 1 mile. No, I'm afraid I cannot. Then, shall I call you a cab? She made it plain that it was my cab. When we got to her gate, she turned her back till I paid the cabbie. You do not look the least like any of your sisters. So I believe. They were people of very considerable means. On the way from the station, she told me that her son had been in the Boer War. He got enteric. The whole family, father, mother, 3 sisters, and the son's fiance, had gone out to South Africa to bring him home. They were just back. It was such a nice little pleasure jaunt. That was the scale on which these people could afford to do things. 6 passages to Africa cost a great deal of money. All the way in the cab, she stared at me. No, she said, I see no resemblance whatever. 3 fine women, if ever there are fine women outside. She stopped to consider and added, 3 God-fearing fine women. She led me into a tasteless chapel-like little drawing room, its walls plastered with framed texts and goody-goody mottos. Put your foot up, indicating a hard, shiny sofa in an alcove. As soon as I was settled, she drew a chair to the side of the sofa. She also arranged a table, a small table on which stood an Apidastra plant, the beast, that beastly foliage thing so beloved of English matrons because it requires no care, will thrive in any dingy room. English boarding houses always had aspidestras. I think it is the only growing plant that I loathe. It is dull, dry, and ugly. When the woman had securely barricaded me into the alcove by her disagreeable self and the hateful plant, she turned full upon me, her gooseberry green stare, scummed over the green with suspicion, mistrust, and disappointment. Again she stabbed. "You differ from your family." Then, in a voice harsh, hateful, cruel, "Are you saved?" Quite taken aback, I faltered. I don't know. "That settles the matter. You are not. I know that I'm saved. I know that my entire family, myself, my husband, our three daughters, my son's fiancé, all are saved. Thank God." She rolled her eyes over the aspidestra as if she pitied the poor thing for not being included in family salvation. The door opened. In marched her three daughters, two stumpy, one lank. Behind them came a maid carrying the tea tray. All the girls had strong, horsey, protruding teeth, like their mother. Introductions followed. I was so shaken by my sudden shove into damnation that, not being yet fully recovered from my illness, tears came. I had to wink and sniff during the introductions to the daughters. For 5 minutes, nobody spoke. Strong white teeth chewed insufficiently buttered muffins. Hard lips sipped tepid tea. I did the same. The silence got unwelcome. I wanted to reinstate myself after my lack of self-control. Mama was obviously upset that my salvation had been interrupted by tea. She drank 3 cups silently and straight off in long, earnest gulps. Looking out of the window, I cried, "Oh, is that the roof of the Crystal Palace glittering over there?"
"Yes."
"That is where the Handel Festival is being held, is it not?
"Yes."
"Have you seen Beerbohm tree in the Henry VIII? I was taken last night. It was simply splendid."
Silence.
"I heard the Elijah in Albert Hall last week. The vast, enclosed empty space made me feel quite queer when we first went into the hall. Does it make you feel that way?" I turned to the lean daughter as being most human.
"No."
The girl was fingering the harmonium in the center of the drawing room. "Are you fond of music?" I ventured, and from Mama in a tornado burst came,
"Our music is hymns at home. Of that, yes. Of concerts, theaters, no. We are Christians."
"But the Elijah, the Messiah, are sacred," I faltered.
"Sacred? The worst music of all. What do those professionals think of as they sing? Their own voices, their own glory, not the glory of God. We are Christians. We would not attend such performances."
A hymn book fell off the harmonium. Did I see the lean daughter's foot steal towards it as if she would kick it under the instrument? Mama stooped and replaced the book on the harmonium. "I'm very tired," I pleaded. "May I go to my room and rest a little?" The lean daughter showed me the way, but she did not speak. Next morning, a letter was passed round at breakfast. The lean daughter tossed it across the table to Father when she had read it. The eldest daughter remarked, "What luck, dear Mama?"
"Providence, not luck, my child."
The lean daughter scowled, and Mama announced, "Brother Simon and sisters Maria and Therese will be with us for luncheon." Turning to her son, "It is my wish that you be here for lunch, my son. Brother Simon and the sisters will wish to see you and ask about Africa." In an aside, the lean daughter whispered in my ear, relatives by faith, not by blood. Certainly I will be present, dear mama, said the son of the house. Faint and chill, the doorbell tinkled under the hand of Brother Simon at noon. It was as if the pull were frozen by brother's touch, but the maid heard and admitted. Mama left the drawing room. There were whisperings in the hall, whisperings that chilled me but made my ears burn. I was introduced. Six eyes tore me as a fox tears a rabbit. Let us pray, said Brother Simon, lifting fat red hands. The fingernails were very dirty. We all flopped where we were and ducked our noses into the seats of the chairs. My chair was in the bay window close to the street. I felt as if I were praying on a housetop. I was sure passers-by could hear brothers roar. At every footstep, I peeped to see how pedestrians were taking it. Suddenly, I heard my own name bellowed by Simon. He was explaining me to God as the stranger within our gates. He told God mean things about me, such personal things as made me feel almost as if I were eavesdropping. He told God that I came of religious stock, but that I was rebellious. I felt my face was crimson when I got up from my knees. The maid was in the doorway waiting to announce lunch. She looked very sorry about something, either a beastly lunch or my sins. The lunch was certainly dreadful. The three visitors bragged how they had defied nurses and doctors to crawl to the bedsides of dying men in Africa for a last remonstrance with them about their sins. They discussed fallen soldiers with the son of the house. Was he saved? No, I said a few words, but I fear not one of those dead soldiers did Brother Simon credit with being saved or deserving to be. At last, lunch was over. The three trailed drearily away. They were booked for a religious meeting. All embraced Mama and the girls effusively. I'd have done them a damage had any of their kisses attacked my cheek. Brother took my hand in a clammy grip. One of his hands below mine, the other on top, was like being folded between raw kippers. I shall, he said, continue to pray for you, my child. Thank you, dear brother, murmured Mama. The kippers fell apart, releasing me. The lean daughter's hand slipped through my arm. Her whisper was directed straight into my ear. Brother and sisters by faith, not by blood. Thank God.